This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies. Terry Gross is out sick today, so I'm taking a day away from my work at the Philadelphia Daily News to sit in for her. Photojournalist Christopher Morris has spent 20 years documenting the horror of several wars, including ethnic conflicts in the Congo, Kosovo, and Yugoslavia, drug violence in Colombia, and guerrilla warfare in Chechnya and Afghanistan. 12 years ago, he covered the first Persian Gulf War. He returned to Iraq this year as a photographer for Time magazine. Morris was embedded with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division, the Tank Division, which spearheaded the Allied attack on Baghdad. His photographs are included in a new collection, 21 Days to Baghdad, the inside story of how America won the war against Iraq, a book of photographs and reports published by Time. Morris has received awards from the Overseas Press Club and the International Center of Photography. Terry spoke with him last week.
I'm going to ask you to choose a photograph that you took during the war in Iraq that means a lot to you, and to describe the photo and tell us how you took it.
What comes to my mind, at least what moves me or I'm attached to, is a picture that Time had published. It's not really the correct frame that I wish they had published, but the moment is close to the image that I prefer. It's of a small boy that was pulled out of his car to be searched. The troops I were with, they were looking for, they called it an RPG team that was ambushing a convoy. And a vehicle came up the road, and it was during a sandstorm, and it's just this small boy with his hands in the air looking very, very frightened. He was probably 7, 8 years old and just being held at gunpoint with his father. So for me, that's an image of the war that I'm proud of, or that I'm glad I was there to at least document that.
Why have you chosen that image to single out?
It's like the boy represented to me the nation of Iraq in a whole. They weren't really, they didn't know what to expect those first weeks when the Americans came across. They weren't welcoming us when we first came in. And there's just a lot of apprehension in his eyes and in his face about the future and what's going to happen. So I just think it has a lot of meaning and a lot of feeling in the photo.
Let me ask you about another photo. You have a picture that's reprinted in 21 Days to Baghdad of soldiers going door to door in Nasiriyah looking for snipers. And there's a picture of a couple of soldiers inside a building, and they don't know what's about to hit them, if anything. You're in the building, too, taking their picture. Is this a safe spot for you to be?
Well, for any photographer, I don't think people realize it, at least in the general public. It's not like with TV crews or even writers. As a photographer, you can't, you have to be basically right there. You have to be within 5-10 feet of whatever you're photographing to capture it properly. So that's just, that's the hazards of the industry that we're in. If you are going to succeed in photography and in photojournalism, you have to get quite close. And this is actually the second day, I think, of the invasion, and it's at the Tilil Air Base, and they're going room to room looking for Iraqi soldiers that are still left over in the air base.
So where were you exactly?
I'm with the unit just going in the door when they go in the door. There's actually probably 5 or 6 other soldiers that are even behind me. So you basically, you work hand in hand with the unit that you're assigned to.
During the war, you were embedded with the 3rd Infantry. Was your subject matter controlled at all by the military? Did they say, you can take a picture of this, you can't take a picture of that?
No, absolutely not. There was no conditions. There were some ground rules that were discussed if there were casualties, that we would be allowed to photograph those casualties. There would just be a delay in releasing any of those photos for notification of next of kin, which is completely fair and reasonable. There was never any time that they said you can photograph this or cannot photograph that.
Were there any things that you saw that you did not want to photograph because you were afraid that out of context the pictures might be misinterpreted?
Well, when we reached Baghdad, there was some... The troops had been without cigarettes and sodas and things of that nature for some time. So there was basically the breaking in of shops and basically what armies do when they reach a city when they've been out in the field for some time. They basically go on their own little looting sprees. So this, I made an editorial decision not to photograph that because this is the units I was with and I was traveling with, and I could see, you know, their desire to finally have cigarettes or whatever reason. It's not like the shops were open where they could stop by and purchase the goods.
Were you surprised or disappointed to see that behavior?
I was not surprised and I was not disappointed because I've covered numerous conflicts over my career in numerous different armies, and that's what armies do. I don't think the American public realizes it or even wants to admit it, but when an invading or conquering army enters a city, there is a certain amount of looting and pillaging that takes place. I was not surprised by it. That's why I did not want the pictures splashed across Time magazine to do, in, you know, some kind of damage to the troops. And I think the U.S. military, after the first week of this, they started to clamp down quite heavily on that, and they frowned upon that.
Well, this gets to the politics of war as seen through photographs. I mean, your photographs could make the soldiers and their mission look really good or look really bad, depending on, you know, if you wanted to weight it in one way or another. Is that
Absolutely.
The kind of thing you think about a lot when you're taking photos of war, that your images could be really loaded?
Well, you try to tell the truth, and you try to be honest with yourself and with the public. I mean, you're there for a purpose and you're there to document. If I saw a killing of a civilian, I would photograph the killing of the civilian and I would put that in my caption. And then it goes through a whole nother filtering process. After you photograph that, then you have to convince your publication that you're shooting for to actually publish it.
Well, there is one photo in the new book of Time magazine photos of a dead civilian that you took, and it's a farmer lying dead in his truck. What was the story behind that picture?
This was, I'm not sure the exact date, but this was when we reached Karbala, and we just dismounted out of our vehicles when a truck came up the road, and a soldier stood up and put his fist in the clenched, the military version of stop. The vehicle kept coming up the road another 5-10 feet, and then they started firing warning shots above the vehicle, and he still continued. So then they fired into the cab of the vehicle, killing one of the occupants. And Time actually did run that, and they actually ran a story on that.
And why did you decide to take the photo of the dead farmer?
Well, I actually shot it in many different ways. There's actually some stronger images because I wanted to document that this man just lost his life, and that the way he lost his life. I know the soldiers I were with, they were kind of appalled at me that I was even taking the pictures. They even said to me, "You're not going to take that picture, are you?" My response, "Well, why am I here?" And I proceeded to climb up in the truck and photograph the dead farmer.
What are your standards as a photographer of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable when photographing the dead?
It's an interesting question. There's different tolerances to this. I know September 11th, when you look at pictures of the World Trade Center, even the pictures when people were jumping out of the buildings, the media got a lot of flack for publishing those. So you don't even really see those very much. But I think it's a disservice to, as a photographer on the scene, I don't try to edit myself before I shoot. I try to photograph it in many ways as possible because it's a historic document that I'm trying to produce. If it's not for that week or that day or that year, maybe for 20, 30, 50 years down the road, I have to make a historic document. So if I come across casualties, especially if they're civilian casualties, I will try to document it even in the most clinical and graphic way. And I know that nobody will publish those photos, at least not initially, but I at least want to have that documented. I want to have it on film or an image of that for a future document, be it in conflicts in Yugoslavia, Chechnya, Rwanda. It's important historically that the public knows that this is what happens. This is what war does to people. This is how they die. Their limbs are ripped off. Their faces are removed. And if you don't document it, it becomes very sanitized and people aren't aware of it.
Do you think at all about the dead person that you photograph and whether revealing them in their death in publication would be something that would go against their wishes? You know, like, are you violating...
Absolutely. Yeah. I know that from covering Yugoslavia and covering what went on daily in Sarajevo, I photographed, I can't even count the numbers of dead, and mostly civilians.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more affected by civilians than I am with combatants. That's their lot in their life. That's the role they're playing, so I'm not really affected. But yeah, I am concerned about that, about the invasion of their soul, so to speak, about photographing them. But I just have to, you know, I don't really know how to say this, but it's just to get the message out that how they were violently killed or what brought about their demise.
So you feel in some way that they would want that information revealed?
Well, I don't know that. I don't know that for a fact.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that for a fact, but it is a very delicate line we're walking. I know that
if I've
approached someone who's found their dead child in the street and he's weeping over their dead child, I could turn and walk away and not photograph that, or I could photograph it and try to make some change to try to help save other children by causing the world to change their actions.
In that circumstance, would you say to the parent grieving over their dead child, can I take your picture, or do you just go ahead and take it?
No, for myself, I would not ask,
mm-hmm.
because I don't want to invade in that person's grieving. If the person stands and looks at me and gestures in a certain way, yes, I would turn and walk away from that. Yeah, it is. It's a very delicate issue. I know that it is pushed. There's a famous photographer who I tried to emulate over the years. His name was Don McCullen. I know this very subject you're talking about basically pushed him over the edge where he couldn't do it anymore. And it was in Lebanon. A woman had attacked him. He photographed her. It was at I'm not sure if it was a car bombing. And it deeply affected him that she physically attacked him for taking her picture.
Did you want to be embedded?
Actually not. And in technical terms, I was not an official embed. I basically had embedded myself. My original plan was to go in unilaterally on my own with the vehicle. But the day before deployment, bringing supplies out to the time rider who was embedded with the third ID, meeting the unit, talking with the unit, they convinced me to go with them. So at the last minute, I had changed my role. In the first Gulf War, I was embedded with the Marines. And so I had done that, and I wanted to try to do it unilaterally because I knew the restrictions that are on me in the sense of logistical restrictions. And that is what I feared most, was you're not really sure what you're going to meet or what military plans change daily. So even if you're tasked to take the airport in Baghdad, by the time you get up to the airport in Baghdad, your mission may be retasked to do something else. You could be guarding a water treatment plant. You could be guarding some bridge on a highway for 2 weeks. It's very limiting when you're embedded in the way we were, in the sense that you can't cover it the way you normally would cover a story. I mean, if something is happening 500 meters away from you, you really can't even get to that because you're with a unit and their unit is not tasked for that mission, so you're basically stuck. You go where they go. You can't move left, you can't move right. You can't go forward, you can't go back, not unless that's their mission. And that's very frustrating, I think, for any of the journalists that were covering the conflict.
When was the first time when you were photographing a war when you realized you might actually die doing this?
The first time was actually in late 80s in Afghanistan. Early on in my career, I decided I wanted to be a war photographer, but it's very difficult to just run off to a war. And so finally I found myself by myself in Afghanistan near Kandahar. I'm not sure if it was 88 or 89. It's already slipping my mind. But I was with a group of fighters that were trying to take the airport in Kandahar. And just before the attack happened, some planes came and bombed our village that we were in, and then through the night they shelled the village. And being in a small village in the desert under artillery shelling is quite frightening, and that's when I realized this is war, this is real, and also the term shell shock. Basically, you just lie flat on your stomach and hope you see the sunrise, and that's when I realized that that was war.
So what was the shell shock like afterwards?
Basically, I wanted to get out of there. I was there for, this was into my third week of being alone without anybody that spoke English and wondering about this career decision that I was, you know, taking. It wasn't until the invasion in Panama that I realized that with war photography, you could do it well and survive. There was a way in combat, where to go, how to move, where to stand, basically how to do photography from very, very close in combat and survive without getting maimed or wounded or killed.
What are some of the things that you learned about that to protect
yourself? Well, just structures. I realized that hiding behind cars do nothing. Where to stand, where to move. People don't realize the invasion of Panama was very quick, but it was quite violent. There were over 1,000 Panamanians that were killed, and there were some very fierce firefights that took place in Panama. And being there and trying to document those, I learned a lot from that. And that's when I would say I became like hooked on being a war photographer.
Well, you've written a little bit about that experience, and you said that, you know, you were caught in a couple of firefights between Panamanians and Americans, and during one of them, you were pinned down for over an hour with a group of civilians. About 18 of them were wounded, and several were killed. Mm-hmm. How did you get through that particular firefight?
That's the one I was talking about. It's just, I realized we were all hiding behind vehicles, and when the vehicles started getting hit with machine gun fire, and the people next to me were getting wounded, I realized that this vehicle's not stopping it. And I rolled over a side of a wall where the Americans were and basically laid down with the Americans behind this barrier. And basically that's how I got through that, where all these civilians stayed up behind the vehicles, which provided them with no protection, unlike in the movies where the police are standing behind the doors firing their weapons.
Right, right. I've seen those films. So were you able to actually get any good photos during the firefight, or were you afraid to...
No, I did well. I kept my cool. I photographed. I even was shooting video at the time and marketed my video that day to the CBS Evening News, which was a big break for me, and they immediately put it on the air. It was right after President Bush at that time was stating that the hostilities had ceased in Panama, and CBS broke into their afternoon soap operas with this video that was shot from Panama.
How did you reach CBS to negotiate with them about what you just shot?
There was, whenever there's military, U.S. Military action at the time, they have, in Washington, they activate what's called the DOD pool, the Department of Defense pool, and they were flown from Washington. A TV crew, some photographers, writers were flown to the U.S. military installation in Panama. So after I shot that video, I worked my way back to the military base, got on base, and found the CBS DOD TV crew, and then struck a deal and sold them the video right there on the spot. And then left the base and went back out onto to continue covering the invasion, where the DOD pool was not allowed off the base. They weren't able to basically do anything. It was also interesting, I don't know if people are aware, there were actually only 4 still photographers that were in Panama when the invasion happened. There was a Newsweek photographer, Malcolm Linton from Reuters, and a Mexican photographer working for one of the Spanish news agencies. And myself, and on the third not the third day, actually the second day, the three of them were wounded near the Marriott Hotel. So after that, I was actually the only photographer there for around 3 days working.
Well, so how did you feel? Like you're the last one standing.
Well, I didn't. I just wanted to keep documenting. I was concerned that I would also survive because I knew two of the photographers quite well, Patrick Chevelle and Malcolm Linton, and the Mexican photographer was killed. I just knew that being now the only photographer left, that I had to keep trying to do as good of a job as I could.
You covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, and you've written that you felt burned out after the first year, but the war dragged on for another 6 years, and you kept coming back during those 6 years. Mm-hmm. You'd leave, but you kept coming back. If you felt so burned out after the first year, why did you keep returning?
That's a good question, but it's like anybody in any career. Once you get on that treadmill of life in a career, it's very hard to get off. Mm-hmm. What do you get off to do, you know, to start a new career? Once you become a war photographer and there's a war going on, what do? You can't just say, okay, I'm going to be a fashion photographer or architectural photographer. So basically, once you're on that treadmill of life, it's very difficult to get off. And it has been very difficult for me to change professions.
You've tried?
I tried. It basically took myself settling down and having a family. And when my first daughter reached around 2 years old, two or three, when I was in Chechnya, that's basically when a very crystal light went off in my mind that I had to do something else. Time had to find me something else to do than just going from war to war to war. Because that's all I basically did for those 10 years.
Well, I should mention, you know, that right before you went to Iraq, your second child was born.
Yes.
Right before.
March 8th.
Did you think of, like, not going?
Well, the thing is, I had promised my wife mm-hmm. around 3 years ago that I would not do any more conflicts. Mm-hmm. This is pre-September 11th.
Right.
And I had asked time to find me something else, and it actually put me on the presidential campaign and now covering the White House, which is very steady work, and I enjoy it. After September 11th and Afghanistan started, I felt something of a kind of pull to go back there, but I knew what Afghanistan was like. I did not like the country, and it was very easy for me not to go. But through some fluke chance of having some contacts with some special forces teams and pitching the story idea for Time, and that it all kind of fell into place. And the next thing I know, I ended up in Afghanistan, and I ended up making two trips for, I think, a total of around 6 weeks. And so I had convinced my wife that this is it, this is the last time, this one's too important to ignore, when all of a sudden this whole thing with Iraq started up. And for myself, my wife, she understands that it's important to me, that it's been my whole life and my whole career, and it would not look right for me if I did not try to cover this conflict. Mm-hmm. But there's always that in the back of your head. You're playing with fate. Is this the last one? Am I making a fatal mistake? And that can be very taxing emotionally on you and your loved ones when you're playing like that. It's kind of like a Russian roulette, because what we do is very dangerous.
One of the photographs you took during the war in the former Yugoslavia was of six children in the morgue. Would you talk about the story behind that picture?
That's probably one of the most emotional things I've ever witnessed in my career, and probably the one thing I've always said that photographers who do this, there's certain things that can push them over the edge or have a breaking point. And I know that people that do this will know what I'm talking about. It's just certain things that you see or experience are just so shocking and so tragic. And that's one for myself. It's this: these children were playing in the snow and were killed by a mortar that fell nearby. And it was just the way they were killed. They were young, ranging, I don't know, 4 to 10 years old. And several of them, they had their faces removed by the shrapnel. And when I say their faces removed, the rest of the body is intact. They're in their little pink snow suits and snowshoes, and they looked like any other Western child, except their faces were removed. And to watch their father and grandfather come in to identify them was very emotional and very shocking. And basically, that really pushed me over the edge.
When you say it pushed you over the edge, what do you mean?
Just anger. Anger at the West at the time. Anger at the...
For not intervening?
Not intervening. Boutros Ghali, Clinton at the time. There was the time that they were saying there was no humanitarian crisis in Sarajevo. And the people weren't starving. They had food. They had water. And my reaction was that these children lost their lives. They didn't have their face. These parents lost their children. And it wasn't happening once a week. It wasn't happening every few weeks. It was happening daily there. The only time that the West stood up and took notice was when there was a market blast or a large number of people were killed, like in the 60s or 70s. But daily there would be 6 or 5 or 3 or 8 or 10. This went on every day. And the leaders in the West just ignored it.
Now, what about this photo you took of the 6 children in the morgue still wearing their snowsuits and gloves? Was that published?
No, it was never published.
Why wasn't
the
it
picture,
published?
The picture, I don't know. I'm not sure, maybe it wasn't strong enough. The picture that I know time ran from that was their sleigh still in the snow, in the bloody snow, was the picture that ran.
Do you think they thought it was like just like too much to see these dead children?
I think that week it was, but the next week was a big market blast, and they did. They put on the cover of a magazine a picture of people from the market blast. So it just wasn't, it was maybe too strong. But that's my point, where you need to document it, even though maybe it's too graphic for the time, but later maybe it can be published.
I should mention that the photo is included in a book, which is called Shooting Under Fire, The World of the War Photographer, which is edited by Peter Howe. And my guest is Christopher Morris. He's a contract photographer for Time magazine. And his photos are included in the new book, 21 Days to Baghdad, from the editors of Time. Well, you said that you'd been trying to get away from covering war because you have a family now, and you don't think it's fair to them to be at risk like that. And you've been spending a lot of your time as a White House photographer for Time magazine, which means you're often traveling with the president. Having covered the war that the president initiated, you must really feel a sense now of the power the president has to use in whatever way he chooses.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I've always known that power, and that's why I was so furious at what I saw going on in Yugoslavia when the power of the U.S. government to put a stop to it, the slaughter of innocent civilians.
And what were your feelings about the war in Iraq? Did you feel like we used our power in a productive way?
It's difficult for me. I don't know if my role in society is to give my opinion.
That's fine. I completely understand that. So
on the war.
Don't feel pressed on that if you'd rather just not have an opinion and just try to be fair with your photographs.
I know that we have bit off more than I think we can handle in the sense that we're in a region and a part of the world where we are not liked. No matter what we do and what good we do or what our intentions are, it will be turned against us. And I think we've opened a very serious can of worms that we're going to have to deal with for some time. And it's not the politicians that are going to have to deal with it. It's these young Americans. They're going to have to go live in that part of the world and put their lives on the line to protect what? Supposedly to protect our freedom.
Well, Christopher Morris, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Photojournalist Christopher Morris speaking with Terry Gross. His photographs of the war in Iraq are included in the book 21 Days to Baghdad, a collection of photos and reports from Time magazine.